Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Windbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Tonight's guest is Lynn McTaggart, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-815-9756, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
Hello, Fran, and I'm very excited and honored to have our guest tonight, Lynn McTaggart. Lynn wears many hats. She's an award-winning journalist. She's a researcher, a lecturer. She's the author of 6 books, including the international bestsellers The Intention Experiments, The Field, and her new book, The Bond. Her books expertly present evidence that we are not separate entities, but part of an interconnected universe. Lynn's website is lynnmctaggart.com, and the specific website for the new book, The Bond, is thebond.net. Welcome, Lynn. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
I think it's fair to say that the majority of people today, at least in this country, think of themselves as sort of flying solo, you know, every person for his or her herself kind of attitude. And, you know, is science telling us otherwise today?
Well, absolutely, and that's why I wrote The Bond. You know, we live according to the story that we've been told about who we are. And the story that we've heard about, you know, the narrative of our lives, is 300-plus years old. It's described a universe of separate and individual things, and more recently, separate and individual things that are in competition with each other for survival. And, you know, many things write the story we live by, but mostly we in the West pay attention to science more than anything else to tell us who we are and what the universe is. And the universe has basically described us as this, and so we have created our lives according to this narrative. You know, we've created competition as the very central engine of our lives. We have competition as the central engine of education, of business, of finance in general, of relationships, even our neighborhoods. You know, God forbid somebody else, one of our neighbors, is driving a Mercedes when we're driving a Volvo.
Right.
So competition is just there and central, and we believe it's supposed to be this way. And my big question really was, in this book, was it supposed to be this way? And the new science in every direction, from quantum physics and biology to sociology, psychology, all the ologies, is no. That's the answer. We were never meant to be this way. Nature did not design us to be competitive. Nature designed us to be cooperative, to come together, to share, care, and be fair. And when we do, we thrive. When we don't, when we compete, we're weak, and that's why we're in the mess we're in.
So we're naturally inclined to be generous and compassionate. I mean, that's sort of been filtered out of us, but it's inherent in our essence, is what you're saying.
Yes.
When you talk about the field, you talk about, you know, the field as being the space in between things. This is a field of consciousness, a field of biophotons. Can we get into a little bit of what actually makes up this bond or the field?
Okay, well, the field is itself a subatomic field. It's created by the energy between subatomic particles. You know, any subatomic particles trade information back and forth like an endless game of tennis. They send energy to one subatomic particle, they get energy back. And that little back and forth energy exchange creates a giant quantum field. That's what I mean by the field. It's basically the field created in the space between things. What I mean by the bond is that, you know, we've been looking for the unit of the world. Scientists always like to take apart the universe like a great big radio and examine the component parts. And they figure they can describe the big things if they understand what the little things are. And for many years, they've been describing and they've been looking for that smallest thing. And the more they look, the more they find smaller and smaller particles and more particles. And the problem is there really is no thing. When they get down to subatomic matter, they understand it's just a vibratory bit of energy. It's a trade. And in fact, it's not a thing at all. That unit, that smallest unit, is not a thing. It's a relationship. And that's what I mean by the bond, because that whole thing of a connection so deep and profound that we can't find where one thing ends and another thing begins is not only doesn't just exist in subatomic matter, but it's mimicked throughout nature between our bodies and the environment, between everyone with whom we come into contact. In all of our societal structures, there is this bond, a connection so deep and integral we can't see where one thing ends and another thing begins.
The field, in a sense, is this underpinning in the universe, and some might say that it records everything. It has a memory or a record of everything that ever was and everything that will be, with no time and space, you know, interference. So, is this field? Do you suspect that the field is what allows things like that we would consider paranormal? Some people might consider things like telepathy and remote viewing and so forth to be paranormal, but might it be the field that's the conduit that allows such things?
Well, this is what I argued in my book, The Field, that this field, as you say, this repository of all information, because, you know, you have to understand quantum particles encode information. They're like a little tape recorder. Every time they bump into another subatomic particle, they encode information. And so the field is just limitless, and by the way, their ability to encode information is limitless. And so the field is this limitless sort of repository of everything, of all information. And so we, being part of this field, theoretically have access to anything, anywhere in the universe. And so that becomes a very neat way of describing how something like remote viewing or precognition even, or ESP work.
I know that you conduct quite a bit of research on intention. I mean, you wrote a book called The Intention Experiments. You participate in research projects. The combined intention is more powerful, maybe a poor choice of words, but is it more effective when groups of people are focused on the same thing than if an individual tries to communicate with another?
Well, I found so. I have been doing a lot of experiments about this, and the main reason I did this was because there wasn't much evidence about the power of groups. There was a lot of tantalizing evidence, but nothing concrete. And so I wanted to find out whether groups do amplify this effect. And so that's why I've run now 23 intention experiments, and 18 have shown demonstrable significant effects. And we've been able to make plants grow faster, purify water, change essential properties of water, and we've had a very provocative study with a peace intention experiment. So we've done some really big things and small things with it. And I've also done a lot of work in small groups of 8 to 12, where I've created healing intention circles and had the group send intention to somebody with a healing crisis or challenge. And we found that the person who gets healed, who gets sent healing, gets better. It might be arthritis, a bad back, migraines, bad stomach, any number of problems, you know, a problem hip, whatever. They seem to be lowered in pain, better movement, resolution of symptoms the next day. And this has been remarkable for me because I never expected it to be this incredible healing, potent healing force. You know, I was just experimenting.
Yeah.
But what also was really interesting, what's been interesting, is the power of this circle, this kind of virtuous circle on the senders, too. They seem to get better, too, in sending intention. Mm. So I think that there is this sending healing property, the sending and receiving property, that seems to be really interesting.
Mm. It certainly does. And talking about health, you know, in the human body, I think there's a common feeling among a lot of people, even in the medical profession, that certain diseases and ailments are predetermined by genetics, and there's really very little we can do about it. You know, it's in the cards, so to speak. You know, possibly it's not true that there's a predetermined biological, you know, blueprint for us. That perhaps, as you suggest in the bond, that our interaction with the environment plays a bigger part than genetics.
Well, I wrote about this in great detail in the bond, looking at our biology. You know, we believe ourselves. This is part of the narrative. And the narrative is very much that, you know, we're individuals and that we are wholly enclosed, self-contained people, and that we are, you know, we are an individual thing separate from all others. And the biggest evidence of that is the fact that we're the creation of a static blueprint, our DNA. But the latest evidence shows that DNA is kind of like the keys of a piano. You play certain keys depending upon environmental influences. So the water we drink, the air we breathe, the food we eat, the relationships we have, the subtotal of the way we live our lives, all of this determines which keys get played. So there's been a lot of evidence showing that that affects a quartet of atoms sitting above genes in order to play that key, particular key or not. All of those showing that the environment may even change genes. There was an incredible study done by a guy called John Cairns, who put some bacteria in a tight spot. He put them in a lactose-rich medium, and these were bacteria that could not absorb and process lactose. So one would have assumed that the bacteria just died off.
Right.
But that's not what happened. The bacteria started creating this fevered mutation process called hypermutation, where just the gene that couldn't process lactose began to mutate until, almost like a photocopier gone out of control, until it created a mutation that could process lactose, at which point the old one was snipped out and the new one put in. So this, demonstrated by this little organism, bacteria, suggested to the scientists the heretical idea that environmental conditions actually change our genes. And what this really means is that we don't get created from inside out, from our genes to our tissues and organs and body. We get created from outside in via our environmental factors, which change the very blueprints of our cells.
Hmm. These discoveries certainly might change the course of medicine in the future. We are talking with Lynn McTaggart, the author of The Bond. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue to learn about the connecting through the space between us. So stay with us.
Has your marketing pitch been missing the strike zone? Maybe you need a new player to help your marketing efforts. At LNRProductions.com, you'll find a team that can give your broadcast advertising the winning edge. LNR Productions has produced award-winning jingles, radio and television commercials for many businesses just like yours. Radio and television advertising work, but you need the right game plan. Make sure you're getting the most out of your ad every time it airs. www.LNRProductions.com. We'll throw strikes for your business every time.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Lynn McTaggart. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Bob?
So, Lynn, if our bodies all produce frequencies, and when we die, when we separate from our bodies, these frequencies, which are affecting, matter being our physical body, the matter is no longer there. So, might it be that these frequencies continue into this field of consciousness?
Well, I think there's pretty strong evidence that consciousness doesn't die, to be honest. I mean, I collect a lot of studies of near-death experiences, coma victims, etc. And, with near-death experiences, yes, it's interesting about everyone or lots of people having similar experiences of the white light and the life review and all of those things. But to me, the most interesting thing is the fact that the person later demonstrates awareness of everything that happened when he was so-called dead.
Right. Well, yeah, I think near-death experiences, I'm sorry, we're breaking up a little bit. If we assume that consciousness is some sort of coherent light, it's interesting how you go back in history and even in the ancient text and even in modern science, light is always discussed as a something as a source and something that we move back into. So
yes, But in this situation, what I'm really interested in is the idea that consciousness, you know, that this and other patients, when asked later, you know, when they're revived, they know everything that went on when they were supposedly dead. In this case, this patient was dead when they took his false teeth out and his clothes off and put them on a crash cart. And the next day when he was revived, he said to the doctor, could you ask that pretty nurse to get those teeth that she put on that cart for me? Now, this was at the point where he was pronounced dead. So you have to say to yourself, well, if consciousness is simply inside the brain and it's just more or less an organic computer, well, this is at the point where the computer's unplugged. So there's evidence like that. There's evidence with coma victims of being absolutely aware of everything that went on. Even after they've been pronounced dead, there was a guy pronounced dead after a crash, and they were about to harvest his organs. When they did a last little check to see whether he was indeed dead, and he moved his foot, and they quickly put away their scalpels, and he woke up afterward and said he was completely aware of everything that was going on. Once again, at a point where his brain was registering absolutely no activity. So for me, that demonstrates that consciousness does not exist inside the brain, that the brain is much more like an antenna receiver and sender, like a television set and a television station all rolled into one. Mm. And I think that's what we're talking about, is consciousness that exists essentially outside the body, that permeates us, and that we tap into.
And there's also some evidence that some people have a hard time grasping the possibility, but there's a likelihood that our memories are not confined to our brains. You know, the memories might be stored elsewhere. And I think you've cited some research that tends to point in that direction.
Yes, well, there's some evidence that I talk about in the field of Carl Pribrams, the neuroscientist, where they did amazing studies on rats, where they taught rats a particular run, and then they systematically destroyed their brains. It was a very disgusting experiment well before animal rights came into play. And they found that even when they destroyed pretty much three-quarters of the rats' brains, it affected their motor movement, so they would stagger along, but they still remembered the run, no matter where they, you know, destroyed their brain. So Pribram decided that memory must be highly distributed and, in fact, probably not even exist inside the brain. Mm. And there is more and more evidence for that memory, like consciousness, is something that exists out there in the field.
Yeah, it's also interesting if you look at some of the evidence from survival research using mediums, you know, that people seem to retain memory, you know, after they move, their consciousness moves to these other dimensions. So it's certainly in keeping with some of those findings.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn, do you think that if we look around, you know, the state of the universe today, there seems to be an increase of both man-made and natural disasters on the Earth. And, you know, would that, do you think, might have something to do with our failure to recognize the bond, to recognize that we're connected not only to each other, but with the Earth and with the universe, and could we change that?
Well, that was what I hoped my book would basically say. I wrote this book to show people that we're living according to an outdated story, that our idea that we're separate and competitive is outdated. It's not supported by science in any way. We were meant to share, care, and be fair. And when we do, we thrive. When we don't, we get in a mess. And I also wanted the book to be a demonstration of the way we can retrain ourselves, because there's so many ways we can. I basically said there were four things we needed to do in the book. We need to retrain ourselves to see much wider than we do right now. We need to create a new relationships and a new purpose for relationships than we do right now. Right now, our relationships are really all about personal gain. We need to start looking at ways to organize ourselves differently so we're not just organizing like with like. That's what we do now. We just look for people who are just like us all the time. And we need to do all sorts of things like that. We need to change our purpose. We need to create a better purpose so it's not just about what's in it for me and mine, but also for connecting, making the connection, making generosity and connecting the main point of our lives.
And when people do become united in a common goal, there's evidence that actually that their brainwaves synchronize in some fashion. Have you is that the current one of the current theories of science?
I'm sorry, I don't really quite understand what you mean.
Well, if you have a group of people that are united with a specific purpose, for instance, focusing on changing global warming, for instance, you know, and you had a good portion of the universe that of Earth, anyways, you know, that's focusing on let's try to do something about global warming. Does it have to do with wavelength, wavelength, if we have a common goal, would my brain synchronize with your brain?
Well, yeah, that's what the evidence demonstrates in certainly in the science, that when people have operate for a common purpose, when there's, for instance, when we're, you know, playing music together, when we're building a barn together, when we're doing what is called a superordinate goal, a goal that can only be achieved by the collective efforts of everyone involved, our brains operate in synchrony. Our brainwaves start operating in synchrony. And we also see that when, for instance, there's a study of Oxford rowers that show that there's enhanced pain threshold, a higher pain threshold when people row together than when they row alone. So working together for a common purpose raises everybody's game. It also unites people, even the most divided, which is one reason why I talk about superordinate goals, goals that can only be achieved by the collective efforts of everyone involved, as being a brilliant way of bringing people together.
So it's possible for brains to synchronize with both positive and negative emotions, then, I would imagine. I mean, if I walked into a room and there were 10 people there and they were all thinking negatively, might my brain synchronize with those negative emotions as I join them? Does it work both ways?
I don't think so. I don't think that there's necessarily a synchrony of negativity, but there is in terms of brainwaves. I think that there certainly is infectiousness. I mean, one thing I talk about in The Bond is how we are infected by negative emotions. We're just great big copycats because we have a real huge need to agree with each other. A woman called Siegel Bersaud found this when she went into her office one day and she noticed that the whole mood of the office was changed. Normally it was so testy and competitive and horrible. And suddenly that had lifted. Everybody was being friendly and talking with each other and sitting around the coffee machine and yakking. And she couldn't figure out what had changed until it suddenly dawned on her that a really grumpy and curmudgeonly coworker was on vacation. And that mood, that positive mood, lasted for the whole of that blissful week. And then when the grumpy coworker came back, the sullen mood descended again. And so from there, she realized that emotions are a bit like viruses and that there's a massive ripple effect that we have on each other. And she's shown in offices, for instance, that when people are infected by a positive mood, they make better decisions than they do when they're infected by a negative mood. And she's, other researchers have looked at this. Harvard researchers have found not only does it pass, in a group and everything, but it passes down a social network so that if I'm happy, I'm more likely to have happy friends. not because I self-select just happy people to be with, but because of the natural spread of happiness. And the same holds true for things like loneliness, for things like overeating. People who, they've had studies having a person sit in the middle of a restaurant and start eating massive amounts of food, and they find quickly that other people start mindlessly eating too, all the people around him. So we're just hugely affected by each other, and it goes down the network. As I say, it goes viral very, very quickly.
You have a very compelling example in the Bond about, you know, cooperative teamwork when you discuss the South Africa rugby team. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. A guy called Don Beck had a brainwave about how to unite the blacks and whites in South Africa right after Mandela was freed and apartheid ended. He decided that they needed some sort of rallying cry. So South Africa was up for the world competition in rugby at the time. And rugby had always been considered really a white man's sport. So he decided to change this and to convince Mandela to wear the Springboks, their national team's shirt at the games, and to encourage the blacks to get involved with cheering for rugby. And he created it as a superordinate goal. That means a goal everybody could participate with. And they use this to overcome prejudice. Now, to give you a wonderful example of what I mean by a superordinate goal, I'll tell you about one of the most beloved studies in history. This was in the 50s, and it concerned a group of 22 Protestant boys. They were 12 years old, and they were sent to summer camp. Now, the camp counselors were all psychologists in disguise. These were in the days before informed consent. And the psychologists had the two groups of the boys, 11 and 11, travel down in separate buses, create separate identities. So one group became the Rattlers, the other the Eagles. They had separate flags. They had separate living quarters. And they were then engaged, when they got there, in highly competitive games for much coveted prizes. So after a while, the psychologists didn't have to stoke any kind of competition. The boys started beating each other up. They started name-calling. They refused to eat together. They invaded each other's living quarters and stole things. They stole the prizes. They beat each other up. It was just, you know, terrible. And no amount of getting-to-know-you evenings could overcome this kind of animosity. So then the scientists decided to create and engineer a series of crises in the camp that could only be sorted out by the collective efforts of all the boys. So they put some impediment in the water supply, and the boys had to work together to remove it. They put a truck in a ditch, and the boys had to work together to get it all back on the road, and so forth. And what happened then was that the boys started eating together. They started talking together. They befriended each other. And by the end of the camp, they unanimously voted to travel back in the same bus together. And one of the leaders of one group spent all of his prize money on ice creams for all the boys. So this is a super perfect example of a superordinate goal. The boys came together despite all that animosity when faced with a crisis that could only be sorted out by the collective teamwork of everyone involved. So I've used that as a model of the way to bring people together who are, you know, polarized. By the quickest way is to create this situation where everybody's working together for a common goal. It just has been shown over and over in studies to be the quickest way to unite people.
Yeah, and we look at the state of the affairs today in the world, and every country is separate, and every religion is separate, and I guess the problem is there are no common goals. Everybody has their own goals. So
right, exactly. Yeah. There are no common goals. When there is a common goal of some sort or a common feeling, let's say like 9/11, in the days after 9/11, when there's a common feeling, everybody comes together. Everybody forgets whether they're Democrat or Republican, Muslim or Christian. And that, you know, happens all too infrequently. So my suggestion, the real purpose of this bond, is to try to offer a blueprint of some of the things that people can do through many of the stories I tell in the book about people who have used superordinate goals to revitalize their neighborhoods. People have used the power of that collective activity and brainwave activity to bring people who are not united together. Take the story of Tailholt, Oklahoma, one of the forgotten neighborhoods of America. I mean, they had tried. It is one of the areas where a lot of Indian Native Americans live, and they had tried and failed to get fresh water for many months because they couldn't get federal money to build a new pipeline, and their water was just really polluted. So eventually, some of the townspeople got together and they said, well, look, let's dig it ourselves. So they did, in consultation with some of the people who are expert in the area. And they not only got their pipeline of fresh water, but they also got a community they never thought they had. People came together over the building of this thing. The men came together and worked together. The women came together and made lunch for the men. And, you know, it created a thriving and connected community then.
Hmm. I know one of the things that you mentioned in the bond is the example of Native Americans. I mean, the way they think is a little bit different. You know, their thinking tends to blend the what they can't see with what they can see. Is that something that we need to do? Stop relying only on our five senses, what we can physically see and hear?
Well, yes. We see, you know, we see the individual thing. Everyone else sees, you know, other cultures see the space in between things. You know, as an example of this, let's just look at the way two cultures would see, say, a painting like the Mona Lisa. Let's say we put a Japanese person and an American person together, and they're observing this painting. Now, the American would zoom right in on the face and probably the eyes, the very epicenter of the painting, because we're taught from childhood to look for the individual thing, to look for the thing itself. And a Japanese person would see something very different. The face would blend into the background. They would see the face in connection with all of the vibrancy of the background, and it is a very complex background when you look at it. You see the figure in relation to its setting. And that really has to do with the way we've been brought up to see and the way we've been brought up to think. When we're young, we're given books like Fun with Dick and Jane, which are books all about the comings and goings of an individual or so. And so we look and we're taught to look at what happens, what an individual gets up to. We're taught to be individual very early, to sleep alone, to make our own choices, to move toward independence very quickly. A Japanese student, a Japanese child, reads with a very different primer. He reads with a book that's something like this. Big brother sitting with little brother. Little brother loves big brother. Big brother looks after little brother. And he's taught to see things as part of an interpenetrating whole, that he is only in relationship to other people. He is because other people are. Mm. And so that breeds a very different way of seeing, ultimately. You know, scientists have found that we in the West see very differently. Even our eyes move very differently than Easterners. And so Native Americans, like many Native cultures, blend the space in between things. They see in the space between things, and they see detail that we no longer see. During the 2004 tsunami, when 250,000 people died, four little Native tribes watched the whole thing from the mountaintop. Some of the tribal elders noticed a few things and decided a tsunami was about to hit. Now, they noticed what our complicated and very sophisticated Western equipment cannot do, cannot predict. They were able to see it, and when asked later how, they said, oh, well, you know, we noticed a little bit of the strange swimming by the fish, and the, you know, the animals were acting a bit funny, and there was a big change in the wind, and they noticed this incredible detail, and that told them a tsunami was about to hit. They noticed the relationship of one thing to another thing, and that breeds this way of seeing through the space between us. So one of the things I talked about the bond in the bond is training our brains, engaging in brain training to notice much more, to notice the space between us, not to forecast tsunamis, although that'd be pretty handy if we could do it, but to understand and notice that more than one reality exists almost all the time, and that it's important for us, if we're to be connected and to reestablish the bond, that we need to take an aerial vision. We need to take a larger approach so that we can see above the whole and we can see these different versions of reality.
And some wonderful advice that you give in the book, and something that I try to incorporate, is try to see things as if you're experiencing them for the first time. I think that's wonderful advice. We are talking with Lynn McTaggart, author of The Bond. Her website, lynnmctaggart.com. The website for the book is thebond.net, and we also have an Amazon link on the Forever Family website for a purchase of The Bond. So we're going to take a short break, and we will return with Lynn McTaggart. Stay with us.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
If you are just tuning in, our guest tonight is Lynn McTaggart. This show is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to our show, we have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. With these hard economic times upon us, some of our supporters write to say they love the radio show, they want to see it continue, they love the work of Forever Family Foundation, but they just don't have extra dollars these days to send our way. Even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do, and yet we want to do so much more. So this is how everyone can help without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. If your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we will receive a donation. And when you find your items in one of their 900-plus online stores, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. The annual Holidays Past raffle is in full swing now. You can win up to 5 medium readings by just buying some chances to enter. Samara Angele, Angelina Diana, Rebecca Ann Lo Cicero, Stephanie Ann Stevens, and Neil Zapusky are the certified mediums who have donated these readings to be raffled off. It's $5 a chance, 5 chances for $20. Please visit our website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org for more information on entering the raffle or mail your check in to Forever Family Foundation, 222 Atlantic Avenue, Oceanside, New York, 11572. Also, our annual conference is coming up in November. Is there chocolate in the afterlife? You can find out by attending November 11th and 12th. November 11th, we will be having our annual fundraiser dinner, Night of Mediums, where you will have a scrumptious dinner and then be joined by a medium at your table of only 12 for an evening of spirit communication. And then early the next morning, we start with our lectures featuring Dr. T. Lee Bauman, M.D., who will present scientific evidence of an afterlife, and Lloyd Auerbach, who will be talking about paranormal phenomena and its implications of an afterlife. We will also have 2 presentations of spirit communication by Teresa Caputo and Angelina Diana. We also have our Holidays Past coming up this year in 3 different states. We've got December 17th at the Melville Marriott in Melville, New York, with Teresa Caputo. December 10th at the Hampton Inn, Boston Natick in Natick, Massachusetts, with Angelina Diana and afterlife advocate Dave Kane. And December 3rd at the Best Western in Bethel, Connecticut, with Joanne Gerber. And those are my announcements. Back to you, Bob.
And we are back with Lynn McTaggart. Lynn, thanks for staying with us. One thing, probably the most important thing that I got out of the bond is the underlying theme that if we can train ourselves to understand the action of others, to realize why they're doing what they're doing, and if we can simulate the experience, you know, from a personal point of view, as if what was happening was happening to us, then we can really make this a better world. We can learn to interact with our fellow man on a much more compassionate level.
We also make it, you know, it works better for us too. You know, everybody thinks that we in the West have been so trained to think about individuality that we think that when we give something away, we lose. And, I mean, this is what interested me in one little story I recalled. from a guy who had been researching natives, and he found, he was comparing numbers, how people handle numbers. And in this one tribe, he said, how, what do you get when you give, you know, if you've got 10 fish and you give 3 away, how many do you have left? And the native didn't blink. He said, 13. He said, how do you get to that? He said, simple. If I give my brother 3 fish, if I've got 10, I give him 3. He takes them and he will give me 3 back. So 10 minus 3 equals 7 plus 6. So plus, he'll give me 3 plus the, he'll give me 3 more. So I end up with 3 more than I started with.
Right.
So he says, you know, you in the West, you're so used to thinking that giving means giving something away. And giving to us is something so rewarding that we always denote it by a plus sign.
Hmm.
So that really made me think, too, about what, you know, what we get. We've been hardwired to feel good about giving. It's in our, you know, it's in our hardwiring. We feel as good about giving as eating and having sex. We have a hardwiring for, we have an it's not fair button in our brains. When something is unfair, when something unfair has been done to us, or we're doing something unfair to someone else, our brain protests. We register an it's not fair, you know, alarm bell goes off, basically. And so by connecting with other people in a different way, changing our relationship so it's all about what do we have to do to create, make ourselves a vehicle of service to this relationship, what do we have to do to help this other person to thrive, what ends up happening is we feel even better than they do. We're hardwired that way. Plus the fact that we'll enjoy better relationships because everybody, it's so contagious. Plus the fact that if we start doing this in groups in the way I talked about, these superordinate goals, we'll have better neighborhoods, we'll have better work environments, etc. So you yourself benefit aside from creating a better world. And that's really the message of the bond, is that we have to change now. You know, we're in crisis now. All of our systems are breaking down. We're in the middle of evolving to something else. And we can go two ways. You know, we're probably the most important generation that is.
We'll work on getting her back. Right now might be a good time if I go ahead and we ask our listeners to join in our prayer.
Okay.
May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind. As we visualize the healing light upon Vicki Steffi, Judith Lachman, Wendy Lippo, and all those people who are still affected by the tragedy in Japan. And we can also say a little prayer for the Gulf of Mexico. Now let's give a little energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, coral, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That was by Masaru Emoto back on May 9th, 2010.
And Lynn?
Yes.
Okay, we had a little problem there. But
yeah.
Okay, we took care of business.
We took care of business. I really appreciate, you know, the work that you do and you continue to do. I know you lecture all around the world spreading this message there is no such thing as an individual thing. I think that if this continues to go viral and continues to be contagious, you very well may play a very important role in the future of the existence of this planet, and we're grateful to you for that.
Well, thank you. Well, I think that I think this is an important message for people to hear now because. And by the way, if people come on our website, www.thebond.net, they'll notice we're going to be putting up a fairness campaign next week. The fairness campaign is all about fairness principles, fairness pledges, so that you can become a change agent for fairness in your life and a change agent for generosity. I mean, one of the big messages of the book is it doesn't take, you know, big changes from the top. to change your life and to revolutionize your community. I mean, we keep waiting for the big guys in charge to change things, but actually, you can do that. You can do it with just acts of generosity. We're so contagious that one act of kindness, one act of generosity ripples down a network and can change a whole culture of selfishness, just like Marie did it. She was so tired of her selfish and greedy office that she decided to leave change in her Coke machine every day, in the office Coke machine, and left a note saying, "Your Coke's been paid for. You know, keep the spirit alive and pay it forward." Well, this absolutely rattled her whole office. They began having a spy network to find out who the Secret Santa was, at which point she moved to another floor and started leaving donuts. And what ended up happening is she ended up changing the whole conversation in that company. That one little act completely revolutionized her company. And that's the kind of thing that we can do just ourselves to make our own little revolution in our own little place.
Those little pebbles spreading the waves in that the pool of consciousness, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I also wanted to tell your listeners, too, that they can get hold of a free extract of the book by coming on to www.thebond.net and just signing in. And they can find out more by signing in about an upcoming large-scale teleseminar that we're running, which is called the Fairness Campaign. It will be featuring not only me, but many leaders in consciousness research like Marianne Williamson, Marcy Shimoff, Jack Canfield, and many, many others.
Well, thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure. I encourage you to go to lynnmctaggart.com, spelled LynnMctaggart.com. You can follow along with Lynn's research and experiments and books and dates. Lynn, they can still participate in intention experiments?
Oh, yes. I've been very much involved in spreading the word about the bond right now, but I am planning a big series of intention experiments for 2012. So please check out our website. Be involved.
Okay. Is that on your lynnmctaggart.com website or the...
We have a www.theintentionexperiment.com. They can find out more on any of our websites, but they can come straight to theintentionexperiment.com and sign up there, and they'll get information by signing up to any one of my communities. They'll get weekly information from me about all of my activities.
And I know I didn't mention it, but you also have written a book about the health industry and what doctors don't tell you.
I have indeed, and we have a newsletter I've run for 21 years called
Right.
What Doctors Don't Tell You. Every month we look at what works and what doesn't work in medicine, and with conventional medicine we have to say the evidence shows not much works. But for better alternatives, people can come on for that. It's www.wddty, that's for What Doctors Don't Tell You, wddty.com. And we're going to be running a big teleseminar about alternative treatments for cancer. I've interviewed many of the pioneers of alternative cancer research, and they have a very practical program anyone with cancer can follow. So it's good for people with cancer, good for people who are relatives of or loved ones of people with cancer. May want to check that out. You can see it also on lynnmctaggart.com.
Do you ever sleep?
It's all good work.
I guess the good work keeps you going, right?
Yeah.
Well, thanks again so much, and we hope to talk
Thank
to you.
You.
Take care.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our healing energy circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon Vicky Steffi, Judith Lachman, Wendy Lippo, and all of the Japanese people who were affected and remain affected by this tsunami. Now let us give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures in Mexico Gulf by praying like this. to the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, coral, algae, and all creatures in our Gulf of Mexico. I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. That was by Masaru Emoto back on May 9th, 2010, after the Gulf tragedy. And now we'd like to remind everyone that
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.